Well, I want to let you know a little bit about my family this morning. So our family, as some of you know, has a 105-pound doodle named Scout. And it's a 105-pound doodle that has zero impulse control, and as it turns out, an unquenchable desire for pizza. And don't get me wrong, Scout is a good boy, okay? I understand. All dogs are good boys. I understand that. But sometimes he just really gets on my nerves. I'm not a dog person, okay? Scout has a special place in my heart, so don't hate me. But I'm more of a cat guy, okay? And so I'm sorry about that. But anyways, so sometimes when he's really getting on my nerves, I'm like, Scout, just don't be the worst. And I didn't realize how much my kids listened to me until I heard Loveland. She was petting the dog one day, and she was talking like in baby talk to it. And she's like, oh, it's okay, Scout. Now, remember what we talked about. Now, don't be the worst, okay? So, anyways, but Scout's a good boy as long as you're paying attention. The moment that you turn your back, he was an opportunist, if there ever is one. We discovered his obsession with pizza on our first family movie night after getting Scout. We were downstairs, and he was still medium-sized at this point, and we took clothes of the pizza box, and we pushed it to the very back of the cupboard. We went downstairs to watch TV, and we hear this crash. And by the time I get up there, evidently Scout had gotten up onto the counter, pulled the pizza box down, and in the 60 seconds it took me to get from the couch to upstairs, he had consumed an entire pizza. Just swallowed it whole. And of course, I looked at him, and he was playing all innocent. And, you know, if Scout could talk, he would say, Joe, it was a good thing that I was there, because this guy just came in from the back door, and he came in, and he stole your pizza, and if I wasn't here, who knows what else possibly could have happened. My father-in-law calls Scout Judas. That's his name for him. And if a dog is a man's best friend, then my best friend would sell me out for a slice of pizza. So that's where we're at. But here's the thing. You're probably wondering, how am I going to turn this into something spiritual? Well, here's that little segue, okay? Here it comes. I'm just telling you it's coming. The plane is going to land. We are so often like Scout. We're good people, morally upstanding citizens, right? Good followers of Jesus. But what happens when no one's looking? What happens when there's an opportunity that presents itself that's too good to say no to, and you know that you shouldn't do it, and you know that it's not right, you know it's not the good thing, but you know you're not going to get caught? Who are you then? Who are you when no one is around watching you? This morning, I want to talk to you about temptation, desiring the pizza, sin, stealing the pizza, and integrity, who you are when no one is watching. And our text for today is found in Genesis chapter 39. And while you're turning there or finding it on your phone, I want to give you a quick recap. Going through this series, we've had a theme verse, Romans 8:28. And it says this, if you can put it up on the slide. And we know that God causes everything to work together for the good of those who love God and are called according to his purpose for them. And we've been following the story where God is going to turn everything around for good. And it's the story of a guy named Joseph, or Joe as I've been calling him, a little bit shorthanded, because my name is also Joseph and I go by Joe. And it tells the story of Joe, but it's actually not just the story about Joe. It's much bigger than that. It's the story of the blessing people. It's the story of God and his faithfulness. And Joe has these dreams where he sees his family bowing down to him. And Joe was already the favorite son, and so he made no mistake in saying to his brothers, hey, just so you know, you're all going to have to bow down to me. And that made his brothers resent him even more, and so they plotted to kill him. And so when they had an opportunity, when no one was around and no one was looking, they took him and they threw him into a pit. And then another opportunity came. Instead of killing their brother, they sold him into slavery into Egypt. And that's where we're going to pick up the story this morning. Jacob's favorite son, Joseph, had a God-given dream that his family would bow down to him. He was thrown into a pit. His dream dies, and now he finds himself in Egypt. Now, if you're paying attention, you may have noticed that we skipped a full chapter. We jumped right from chapter 37 to chapter 39. And there's a reason for that. Chapter 38 is only sort of connected to the story. It's important, but it supports the broader picture. And we'll talk a little bit more about it later. But all you need to know for now is that Judah, that's the opportunistic brother who is like, hey, let's sell our brother into slavery. He leaves his father's house, and he makes a series of very poor choices. Not the least among them is sleeping with his daughter-in-law because he mistook her for a prostitute. But Judah's biggest sin, out of the many errors and mistakes that he makes, is that he is his unwillingness to ensure that the family line continues through him. But yet, God makes a way for that to happen. So we're going to talk more about that later. It does connect, I promise. And this is the kind of stuff that you come across in the Bible and it just makes you scratch your head a little bit and you're like, man, that is graphic and that is, why is that in here? But there's a reason. So we're going to jump in on Genesis 39. We're going to read verse 2. Joseph finds himself in Potiphar's house. He's the captain of the guard and he's a slave there. And it says this, the Lord was with Joseph. If you've got an underline, underline that. The Lord was with Joseph. So he succeeded in everything he did as he served the home of his Egyptian master. Joseph was a slave under a man named Potiphar, the captain of the guard. And everything that he put his hand to, God caused blessing. God caused everything that he did to prosper and to multiply. And so what ends up happening is Potiphar sees how well Joe is doing, and he says, hey, I want to put you in charge of my entire house. And in fact, it says a little later on that the only thing that Potiphar had to worry about is what it was he wanted to eat that day. That is the kind of administrative abilities Joseph had. That's the kind of blessing that God had placed on his life. And so everything seemed to kind of turn around a little bit for Joseph. You know, his life was going like this, and then it seems to be moving up until one day. And we're going to pick it up at the last half of verse 6. It says, Joseph was a very handsome and well-built young man. And Potiphar's wife soon began to look at him lustfully. Come and sleep with me, she demanded. But Joseph refused. Look, he told her, my master trusts me with everything in his entire household. No one here has more authority than I do. He has held back nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God. She kept putting pressure on Joseph day after day, but he refused to sleep with her, and he kept out of her way as much as possible. One day, however, no one was around when he went in to do his work. She came and grabbed him by the cloak, demanding, "Come and sleep with me." Joseph tore himself away, but left his cloak in her hand as he ran from the house. When she saw that she was holding his cloak and he had fled, she called out to her servants. Soon all the men came running. Look, she said, my husband has brought this Hebrew slave here to make fools of us. He came into my room to rape me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream, he ran out and got away, but he left his cloak behind with me. Now, naturally, when Potiphar heard this story or this version of the story, he was enraged. And so he takes his trusted servant, Joseph, and he throws him into prison. And so just so we're clear, just so we know where we're at so far in the story where God turns everything together for good, Joseph is stripped of his favorite robe, thrown into a pit, sold into slavery in a foreign land, and just when things are starting to go his way, he is wrongly accused and thrown into prison. But his story isn't over yet. In Genesis 39:21, it says this, but the Lord was with Joseph. Underline that. The Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. And it goes on to say that the warden actually put him in charge of all of the other prisoners, which is pretty cool. But I mean, still, favorite prisoner is still a prisoner. But don't miss the sandwiching of a narrative between the phrase, the Lord was with Joseph. When you read the Bible and it sandwiches a story between two phrases that are the same, that's an important thing. And it's crucial to the entire story. And the term Lord there, in this particular instance, refers specifically to the God who keeps his covenant promises. Specifically to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as readers of this story, we get the luxury of knowing that the Lord is with Joseph. We read this and we're like, yeah, okay, God's got everything in control. Let's see how this works out. But in our own story, we don't get that luxury, do we? There's not footnotes scrolling by us that say, but the Lord is with Joe. When you're having a hard time, we don't see that. We hit something that we have to take by faith. And so this morning, what I want to do is I want to focus on the temptation of Joseph, because his temptation teaches us a series of valuable lessons. And the biggest lesson it teaches us is this: there is always a reason to sin, but there is never an excuse. There's always going to be a reason to sin, but that reason does not provide you with an excuse. There's always a way out of temptation. In 1 Corinthians 10:13, it says this: the temptations in your life are no different from what others experience. So often when we're tempted to do wrong, we think that we're the only ones, that we're isolated, that we're alone, that no one else has experienced this, no one else is going through this, no one else has dealt with this. But that's just not true. And then it says, and God is faithful. The Lord was with Joseph. The Lord is with you. He will not allow the temptation to be more than you can stand. When you are tempted, he will show you a way out so you can endure. And so this morning, I want to talk about the way out of temptation. Point number one is understand the gravity of sin. Now, sin is kind of a weird word now, isn't it? I bet you if you ask 10 different people, you would probably get 10 different definitions about what sin is. You know, what is it that makes something right or wrong? A lot of people think that it's culturally set in. It's the society that decides what's good and what's bad and what's right and what's wrong. And maybe so, that's partially true for some smaller social norms. You know, when someone upsets a social norm that you wouldn't really call a sin, you're like, that was kind of weird. Why would you do that? Right? But is everything socially constructed? Culture across the world knows that you shouldn't murder and you shouldn't steal. Those seem to be pretty universal. And as much fun as it would be to go down a rabbit hole of, you know, philosophically, how do we define sin? What I want to do this morning is I just want to give you a Christian perspective, a biblical understanding of what sin is. First of all, sin is what separates us from God. And this is really, really important to know. If you don't have a relationship with God, it's sin that separates you from your relationship with God. If you're a follower of Jesus, and this isn't the case all of the time, okay? Sometimes we just go through dry seasons. Joseph is in a pit and he didn't sin to end up in there. He's a slave and he didn't sin to end up there. But sometimes the sin in our own lives, we put up a wall between us and God. And you might say, okay, but how does that work? Why would sin put up a wall between God and I? Well, the reason is this, is the second thing that you need to understand is that sin is, at its essence, substituting ourselves for God. Wanting the kingdom, all the good things that God has to offer, wanting the good life, wanting everything our way. And that was the original sin, right? The serpent comes to Adam and Eve and says, you know, did God really say that? If you do this, you will become like God. And when we sin, it's saying, God, I know what your word says. I know, you know, the sins that are laid out here. I know in my conscience what is wrong. I know by your Holy Spirit what is wrong. I just don't really care. I just want to do it anyways. So sin at its essence is substituting ourselves for God. And then thirdly, sin corrupts God's creatures and creation by bringing destruction and ultimately death. Here's a reality. Your sin doesn't just affect you. It affects the people around you. It affects relationships. It affects creation. It affects animals. It affects all kinds of things. It just spreads and spreads and spreads until ultimately it ends in death. Now, many people assume that sin occurs only when you harm someone else, right? That's a pretty common cultural definition of sin. Well, it, you know, I wasn't harming anyone. I wasn't, you know, hurting anybody by doing this. But that's only one dimension of sin. There's actually three different dimensions to sin, and Joe gives us all three in his response to Potiphar's wife. In verses 8 and 9, he says, "Look, my master trusts me with everything in his entire household. No one has more authority than I do. He has held back nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing? It would be a great sin against God." So here are the three dimensions of harm. The first one is others. Sin harms other people. Joseph says, "My master trusts me." In other words, if I was going to do this, I would betray my master's trust. I would harm him by doing this. Secondly is yourself. How could I do such a wicked thing? Joseph understands that the effects of sin don't just affect other people around us, but they also have an effect on the kind of person that we choose to be. And third and most importantly, very clearly he says, it would be a great sin against God. All sin ultimately is against God. There's a psalm where David is praying and he says, "God, against you and you alone have I sinned." And that was, I think, when he murdered someone. So, all sin is against God. And the lie of temptation is that it isn't a big deal. I mean, we've all been tempted and we all know it. There's for every reason not to sin, there are 10,000 reasons to go ahead and just do it. But there is always going to be a reason to sin, but that does not mean that there is an excuse to sin. And Joseph finds himself, like us, in a very familiar, repeated cycle of human behavior. This is really fascinating. If we talked about Adam here in the book of Genesis, it opens up with Adam and Eve, right? And Eve and Adam are told not to eat the fruit, and Eve sees the fruit, she takes the fruit, and she offers it to Adam. And so Adam sees the fruit, and he takes it, and he eats it. And then we come to Abraham, and Abraham's supposed to have a child of the promise, and he can't. And so Sarai, his wife, says, "Hey, take my female slave and marry her too." And so, knowing that it's not God's plan, Abraham sees her, and he takes her. And then we end up with Jacob, who more or less mirrors the serpent himself who's tempting other people. He's just trying to take everything he can, every which way he looks. He's like, "I want that, and I want that, and I want that." He's striving and scheming to get everything that he possibly can. He sees and he takes. And then we come to Joseph. Joseph saw. Potiphar's wife offered. But he broke the cycle of sin. And so what that tells us is something truly incredible. And what it tells us is not that Joseph was some kind of superhuman person, but what it does tell us is that there is a way out of temptation. There is a way to break the cycle of sin. Now, did he win an award for breaking the cycle? No, he ended up in prison. He got jail time. And so often we think, what is the purpose of doing good? Why would I even bother doing the right thing if I know that in this situation, doing the right thing is going to lead to my immediate harm? Because doing good is its own reward. Remember that phrase, "The Lord was with Joseph"? It helps us see the bigger picture of what's going on here. Your integrity may cost you more up front, but the wages of sin is death. See, I would rather be with the Lord than separated from him with all of the luxuries in the world. It's almost like a wise man once said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world yet loses his soul? That wise man was Jesus, by the way. The way out of temptation begins by understanding the gravity and the seriousness of sin. Secondly, it's important to create healthy boundaries. Now, we're all familiar with the term boundaries. It means creating guardrails, right, to help us make good choices in our life. But I found a really great illustration of boundaries, and it's from an old children's book I used to read as a kid, Frog and Toad, and I want to read it to you. Toad baked some cookies. These cookies smell very good, said Toad. He ate one, and they taste even better, he said. Toad ran to Frog's house. Frog, Frog, cried Toad. Taste these cookies that I have made. Frog ate one of the cookies. These are the best cookies I have ever eaten, said Frog. Frog and Toad ate many cookies, one after another. You know, Toad, said Frog, with his mouth full, I think we should stop eating, or we will soon be sick. You are right, said Toad. Let us eat one last cookie, and then we will stop. Frog and Toad ate one last cookie. There were many cookies left in the bowl. Frog, said Toad, let us eat one very last cookie, and then we will stop. Frog and Toad ate one very last cookie. We must stop eating, cried Toad as he ate another. Yes, said Frog, reaching for a cookie. We need willpower. What is willpower? Asked Toad. Willpower is trying hard not to do something you really want to do, said Frog. You mean like trying to eat all these cookies? Asked Toad. Right, said Frog. Frog put the cookies in a box. There, he said. Now we will not eat any more cookies. But we can open the box, said Toad. That is true, said Frog. Frog tied some string around the box. There, he said. Now we will not eat any more cookies. But we can cut the string and open the box, said Toad. That is true, said Frog. Frog got a ladder. He put the box up on a high shelf. There, said Frog, now we will not eat any more cookies. But we can climb the ladder and take the box down from the shelf and cut the string and open the box, said Toad. That is true, said Frog. Frog climbed the ladder and took the box down from the shelf. He cut the string and opened the box. Frog took the box outside. He shouted in a loud voice, hey, birds, here are some cookies. Birds came from everywhere. They picked up all the cookies in their beaks and flew away. Now we have no more cookies to eat, said Toad sadly. Not even one. Yes, said Frog, but we have lots of willpower. You may keep it all, Frog, said Toad. I am going home now to bake a cake. Defined by Henry Cloud, boundaries are basically about providing structure. And structure is essential to building anything that thrives. Human flourishing requires healthy boundaries. You know, Joe may not have been able to feed, you know, his temptation to the birds, but he did everything in his power to create healthy boundaries. In verse 10, it says, she kept pressure on Joseph day after day, but he refused to sleep with her, and he kept out of her way as much as possible. How often, when we are faced with temptation, instead of trying to keep out of the way of temptation, instead of trying to put up healthy boundaries, we say, you know what, I think I can just be close to that temptation. I think I can entertain it a little bit. I think I'm strong enough to handle it. But boundaries recognize three crucial truths. The first is it's not a matter of if you'll be tempted, but when. Secondly, it has a very realistic and humble view of human weakness. You know, one of the things that Christians have been blamed for, and rightfully so many times, is judging other people who sin. and saying, oh, look at how sinful this person is and look what they did. But until you're in that person's shoes, until you have experienced the weight of temptation that they have experienced, until you've had to fight that, you don't know what you would have done in the same situation. And healthy boundaries say, look, I think if I'm put in this situation, there is a very real opportunity that I'm going to sin, and so I'm just not going to even go there. So third, boundaries are a sign not of weakness, but a sign of strength. It's recognizing our weaknesses and protecting ourselves. Boundaries are all about safeguarding your most valuable commodity, your character. You know, it's happened to me before a couple times, and this happens with any figure who's a public figure, is that sometimes people will slander you. And I remember this one time, I don't even remember what the instance was, but someone was spreading rumors about me, and my wife said to me, Joe, aren't you worried about what it is that these people are going to be saying about you? And I said, honestly, no. Because anybody that knows me knows that I would never do that. That's how powerful character is. Character can fight for you without you even opening your mouth. When you have godly character, people can say the most evil, most vicious things about you, and your character will speak louder than any words ever can. So it's important that we understand the gravity of sin, that we create healthy boundaries. And thirdly, sometimes the only way out of temptation is to flee temptation. Can we just acknowledge for a second that Joe ran away from an opportunity that most people would have leaned into? Again, opportunity to sin does not provide an excuse to sin. And if we look at the life of Joseph, Joseph had more reasons to sin than most people who would be put in that position. Let's take a look at his reasons. He was truly in isolation. There was no one that he knew nearby. He had no family, no relatives, no lifelong friends. He was in a foreign land, all alone as a slave. You want to talk about trauma? Rejected by your family, thrown into a pit, sold into slavery? I think that's going to rack up the counseling bill. Loneliness? Man, the guy just needed a win. He just needed a break. Life was negative after negative after hard after heavy. He just needed a win. And in a story where everything is supposed to turn out for good, life has been so hard on Joe. He had every reason. He also had every single opportunity. First of all, it says he was a stud. Joseph was young, handsome, and good-looking. And let's face it, Potiphar's wife was probably a babe. If you're a wife of the captain of the palace guard, you're probably good looking. Not only that, she really, really wanted Joe and was forcefully insistent. No one else was around, right? One day when no one else was around, no one would ever know. What does he do? He runs. He removes himself from the situation because he didn't put himself in that situation. In fact, he tried as hard as he could to stay out of that situation, but that situation came to him. And what did he do? He ran. And so often we place ourselves in those situations on purpose, deceiving ourselves, telling ourselves that we're strong enough. I love what 2 Timothy 2:22 says. It's easy to remember because it's 2:2:2:2:2. Run from anything that stimulates youthful lusts. Instead, pursue righteous living, faithfulness, love, and peace. Enjoy the companionship of those who call on the Lord with pure hearts. See, the pursuit of what is good is essential to fleeing what is evil. And this is really easily illustrated. If I tell everyone in the room, don't think about pink elephants, whatever you do, just stop it. Right now, don't think about pink elephants dancing or like with balloons being carried up above your head. Don't think about it. Flee from it. Run away. Everyone's thinking about pink elephants in the most absurd ways possible. And sometimes that's what happens when we approach the Bible. We come across things, it's like, oh, God doesn't want me to do that or that or that. And so you go through life and you're like, okay, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. You know, if it's fine, I better not do it. Just stay away, right? And we have this, we're just so focused on God doesn't want me to do this, and God doesn't want me to do that, and God doesn't want me to do that. And all we can see are opportunities to do those things. But the Bible gives us a different way. The Bible says to pursue righteous living. Sometimes the question is not what is right and what is wrong. The question is what is good. Because what is good will be what is right. And that is something that is worth pursuing. I love what Mark Batterson says. He says, you may not be responsible, but you are response-able. You may not be responsible for the situation that you find yourself in, for those moments of temptation, but you are response-able to how you respond. I'm going to invite Tim to come on up. So here's the thing, though. I know that there's many people who are sitting here, and you're thinking to yourself, you know what, that's all really great, but I'm not like Joseph. I've messed up. And chances are really good if I was in his position, I would mess up again. And so then is the application point, how do I become more like Joe? How do I become more like Joseph? Well, that's a good question. But I want to jump back to Judah and his daughter-in-law, Tamar, for a second. Judah does everything wrong. He does not resist temptation. In fact, he goes out looking for temptation, the opposite of what happens to Joe. He sins more than once. He has evil intent. And yet, God turns it around for good. Tamar would become an ancestor of King David. And King David was an ancestor of Jesus. So here is a guy who is obstinate and stubborn and self-serving, and yet God is faithful to him and blesses him. And then we have Joseph. He does good, he acts with integrity, and he still ends up in prison. Judah is free, Joseph is in prison, and yet God is with Joseph. Now, I don't know about you, but that does not seem fair. That does not seem right. Sometimes we go through our lives and it's like, God, I'm being really good. I'm trying to follow you. I'm trying to follow your commands and do what's good and not stay away from, you know, stay away from sin and do all of these things. And I'm looking at everyone else's life and they seem to be doing so awesome. You really seem to be blessing them. It's just not fair. But friends, there's a great comfort in the fact that God is not fair. Because we can be confident that our faithfulness does not determine God's goodness. That our sin can never overshadow his ability to turn all things for good. Nowhere do we get a clearer picture of this than on the cross. If sinning is assuming the place of God, God comes down and he saves us by assuming the punishment of our sin on our behalf. If the heart of sin is substituting ourselves for God, then the heart of salvation is God substituting himself for people. So friends, the moral of the story isn't be more like Joseph. But yeah, of course, run from sin, flee from it, put in healthy boundaries. Because Joseph was with God. The Lord was with him. And I would rather go through the fire with God than experience all the luxuries of the world without him. But the moral of the story is not be more like Joe. The moral of the story is put your trust in Jesus, the one who carried your sin on his shoulders, the one who paid the price for all your wrongdoings, all your mistakes, and all your blatant acts of disbelief.
Friends, what I want to do this morning is I want to invite you, if you don't have a relationship with Jesus, if you're here and you say, you know what, I'm here in church, and maybe I've heard this message before, maybe I haven't, but I know I don't have a relationship with Jesus, but I want to be free from sin. I want to experience the joy and the life of the Lord. I want God to be with me. I'm going to invite you to say a prayer with me. So if everyone would mind just closing their eyes for a moment. And if that's you, and you don't have a relationship with Jesus, but you would like one, would you just lift your hand? No one's watching. Just raise your hand. Thank you. I see that hand. See that hand. Thank you. Anyone else? Right on. Thank you. I just want to invite you to say this prayer with me. Dear Heavenly Father, I know that I'm a sinner. I ask that you would make me clean. Father, I thank you that you saved us through Jesus on the cross. I believe in you. Lead me into your new life.